ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Nick Childs. He was a creative leader at multiple agencies and made everything from Super Bowl spots to micro campaigns across digital, experiential, mobile search, and more. He's a director, writer, and producer, as well as co-founder of Dirt, an AI-powered content measurement engine. Today, we're going to be talking about his career journey and this latest venture. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
During our pre-interview, we talked about your exit from the agency world. A lot of people working in advertising worry about finding themselves on the street when they still have one or two college tuitions yet to pay and at least a good 15 years remaining before they ever wanted to consider retiring. Also, what you went through back then and how you evaluated your options and choices, all that internal work informs how you approach what you're doing now. So I'd like to touch on that first. When you looked at the landscape and where you were, what was your thought process and how did you come to be part of your current venture?
I will start with the first part of that. My immediate reaction to being somewhat unceremoniously dumped out of the advertising world, at least for that moment, was panic. I had two college tuitions, as you mentioned. That's the age I was at. I had just turned 50. And I knew I had, a decade, 15 years, two decades, a bunch of time that I wanted to keep working. And I think as we get older, work changes, right? Hopefully, luckily, you do well and you're privileged to be able to look at work in a way that, for me at least, you can start to give back a little bit more. I can start to be a bit more focused about the approach I want to take with my remaining years. But certainly at that moment, I was struggling with the desire immediately to get back into the game. Right. To think about just, where do I take another chief creative role and how do I do that? And there was a little bit of maybe I should look more pragmatically or more intelligently or more strategically at going back to an agency model where I could have a real impact. I had jumped into some agency models of PR and media where the ask at those places really wasn't to be creative. I think the intent and the desire to grow into creativity was great, but clients weren't necessarily paying those groups for it. It was very hard to build those teams. And I think I looked at that and my agency and whether or not I could build those teams well aside, I felt like it was a Sisyphean task. So I was looking at getting back into the ad world, having conversations with people. But at the same time, Gabriella, as I think we've talked about and other people realize, is as you get older in advertising, thinking that you're going to be the lone wolf who continues to lead the pack late in your years is not intelligent. Is a little bit
naive. I will be the exception. Yes.
I will be the one person. Also, I think it becomes a space where you're moving up into management. I was just having this conversation with a wonderful artist the other day who had moved into management at IDEO, and she was saying the same thing. And it just echoes and resonates for me with so many people that I speak with. You move into management, you're getting away from doing the thing that you enjoy doing. And by enjoy, I don't mean just selfishly chasing your passion. I mean, because you enjoy doing it, I believe you tend to deliver more promise and success in that way. So I was looking at getting back into the field, understanding that getting back into the field would probably and most likely mean that I would be in that same situation a year or two later again with even more limited opportunities. And so I started to think about other things that I might do. I was doing artistic, creative, directing projects on the side that had launched at major film festivals. So I immediately jumped into doing one of those projects for Tribeca, another one for New York Film. In the coming years, I did some consulting, but I was really more energized by moving on into a totally different field that leveraged all of the various pieces that I've been trying to put together for creativity and strategy and thinking and writing and directing and producing and making, but in a new way, not directly back with making advertising.
Right. Now let's talk about how you came to your current venture. So you've decided to think different, if you will. What made this the thing that you decided you were going to dive into?
I will give full credit where it's due, which is to the lead partner, our CEO, Ryan Anthony, who I had known over the years, and he had come up with this dream of forming a company that we did called Dirt. He had been building a version of it at a company called Fungal for years, and that company had exited and sold to Blackstone about a year before, and he wanted to put what he had been building, biometric neuroscience, at the center of it for audience attention, to measure audience attention, at the forefront of building his own thing. And he invited our chief science officer and me to join him on that ride. A very quick aside, I luckily put these pieces together, or I'm so grateful for the weird ways these pieces come together. I had met Ryan years before. I think it had been maybe 7 years before, because I had given a talk at a conference where the night before my talk, the next morning, I decided not to do the boring talk about media and creativity that I kind of had thought I was teed up to do. And I gave a talk about 10 ideas I'd seen in the last 24 hours that anybody in the audience could steal and do on their own. And he saw that. And I think he was one of probably the minority in the audience who was not just completely confused by
it. Like, I came for this other thing. What is this? Yeah.
I thought I was just going to be able to enjoy my bagel and coffee and kind of drown this out. And I came in all hot and enthusiastic and passionate and talked about really weird stuff. And he came up to me and said, that was pretty cool. I really liked that. And we became friends. And I think he saw the way I like to try to put those pieces together and the various assets that I had in my background, and saw a role for me at Dirt as a creative leader, as somebody who can be a marketing leader, as somebody who is curious and wants to learn a lot more, even in spaces that I knew very little about, which was kind of AI at the nascent stages 3, 4, 5 years ago. And so he invited me in, and I was able to, at that time, and maybe it's because of experience or just the arc of my career, take a risk that previously in my career I wouldn't have done. I was able to say, I'm able to defray the immediate gratification of something that's going to more easily pay for college tuition, or be the thing that everybody else is going to come ask me to talk about, or the thing I know and is quote unquote easier for me to do, and take a risk on something that had I thought a much more promising reward in the long run. And also understand, which I love now, is this idea that even if it doesn't pay off, and kind of especially when it doesn't pay off, that learning, which I will not label as failure, is what makes life way more interesting and has a far greater payoff.
Right. Well, now let's dive in to Dirt and emotional analytics, the science of art, which sounds great, but I'm not sure I understand what it means. So can you explain it a little bit?
I can. We, in early days, 3.5 years ago, were forming a company that sat kind of at the fulcrum of research for audiences. We never intended it for us to just kind of break the back of how that research was being done, but to grow into where we build now. But I would have explained it very differently even 6 months ago. I would have said we do research in the lab where we bring people into a laboratory-like setting. And by that, I just mean a bunch of computer stations. And we hook them up to a device that looks like an Apple Watch and has two electronic sensors that go to the palm of their hand or to their fingers to read through the infinitesimal change in their skin sweat as they're looking at anything or hearing anything, a content in front of them that tells us exactly how their brain is reacting to that content. And by reacting to, I mean emotionally connecting to and seeing if that content is relevant in the moment to them. So if you think about A/B testing and surveys and focus groups, you're asking a participant to tell you what they think they feel or see or liked or disliked or reacted to. What we do in the field of neuroscience and biometric neuroscience is we use various different scientific methods to understand exactly what's happening in their brains, so we don't have to ask them that question.
I've interviewed researchers who look at functional MRIs.
Yes.
But this is, so is it similar to that? And how did you test the accuracy? I mean, yes, so, they're sweating. How do I know that that's whatever it is?
So that's a great question. It is similar to fMRI and EEG. If we kind of lay out a spectrum, and fMRI and EEG are on one side of it that is challenging. If you think about functional MRI and you're putting devices on people and they're generally in a much more clinical setting, not even a kind of computer lab setting, but they also
you're in a giant tube.
You need it too. And you need right. focus. And the reason I'm not the scientist, but the way I would describe it probably terribly is the reason you need a tube is because you're trying to filter out all of the noise to find the signal that you're getting. So if you used the story that our chief science officer would say is if you're using fMRI or EEG to try and understand what somebody's brain is reacting to and finding relevant in the moment, in the instant, in the microsecond, it's kind of like standing at a very crowded place, a party or a Grand Central Station, and hearing someone say, yell Gabby, and you turn your attention to it, only they actually were yelling for their friend named Jerry, right? There's just a lot of noise happening, and it's very hard to signal out the thing that you want to get. On the other side of the spectrum, much easier to get the scientific measurement on are things like eye tracking and facial recognition. And eye tracking, we use a little bit of, and it allows you to generally very quickly over a larger group of participants see where people's eyes go when they're looking at a screen. And we use some of that for validity just to measure if our clients want it, where they were paying attention visually in the moment. Facial recognition really doesn't work. It works for certain things of understanding who somebody is, but to understand emotions, to understand relevancy in the moment, it's just, we don't code that way. You can think about it in terms of you could be looking at somebody smiling at you and they could be thinking that they hate you. More right. importantly, nowadays, if you're participating and having a conversation with somebody on Zoom, the second a screen is involved between you and whoever you're speaking with, we tend to also show significantly less emotion in the situation. So the validity of using those tools isn't important to us. We kind of sit in the middle with this thing called galvanic skin response. And that's what I was talking about, this device that measures skin sweat. And what's happening is it's measuring a physiological reaction that for decades has been a, if not the most highly dependable signal of the brain marking something as relevant and a powerful indicator that helps us better understand and predict audience and consumer behavior. And the way just storytelling wise, I'd say it is your brain all the time, always on, is acting like an air traffic controller, right? And it's deciding what needs to land at any given moment, and it's redirecting everything else. The devices we use and the process we use and the process we're building to be an AI-powered solution that people can use remotely, it allows us to help creators of all shapes and sizes, from massive billion-dollar companies to an individual making design decisions on their own website, to see where audiences are or are more likely to pay attention to the content they're making and where they can allow the other stuff to go away and be redirected.
So it's part of the human relevancy filter that yes. they're engaging with it. Okay.
Yeah. It's directly in cognitive science, it's called an arousal response. And that's right. a fancy way of saying that we're in a higher state of alertness and awareness. And one byproduct of that, our pupils dilate, our heart rate becomes variable as the body conserves resources. And then there's this thing, this microscopic increase in surface moisture on your skin. And by measuring that, and people have been doing this in decision-making research for decades, it's a really robust, low-cost way to kind of measure the cascade of those cognitive processes that I just described.
You just said low cost, because as I'm listening, it sounds very high tech, really intriguing, but also costly. And I'm thinking, well, two things. First, you've been in business a while. Do you have existing clients? What kind of infrastructure is this? Does this require for you?
Low cost and robust. I'm speaking directly about the devices that we're using. It is not an MRI machine.
Right. Okay. So fMRI. Different. It's not MRI level. Okay.
Right. So it's not that. So it's a relatively inexpensive, in quotes, way to gather that information. Now, because we have to gather it on hundreds of test participants, and we had to do it in lab to start because that's the way it's been done for decades and nobody had changed that. That is expensive. And the cost of doing these tests, you are absolutely correct, and it's really important to say, was very expensive for a long time. Our intent as we shaped and formed DIRT, and we have been doing this since day one with multi-billion dollar international companies across gaming, across content creation, across social media. We've got clients like previously Twitter, which is now X. We've got massive gaming clients in Zynga and 2K under the Take-Two umbrella. We've worked with Amazon. So there are large corporations who can afford to take the bet on expensive research. We started the research to say, like anybody hopefully does with a great idea where they're saying like, wait, this is kind of broken. How could we make the lab experience more efficient? How can we bring those prices down? And over the last 3 years, we've taken in the lab side of it and the more consultative side, which is not the direction we're building now because it doesn't scale, but we could build there. We've taken what was a process that took months to return information to a client on a test and cost in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to do a test. We've taken that down to we can turn around a top level look at what the test did within 12 hours. And we've reduced the cost of that by about 500% less. So we've taken something that costs in the hundreds of thousands to under 40,000 as an offer now. That was not our original goal. What we were building the company to do was certainly to break the back of that expensive, cumbersome, timely testing and be able to democratize it and offer it to a lot of other clients, right? We were taking and we have developed the software to use these biometric devices and send them to real people in the real world so that they can take these tests on their own time in the comfort of their home or where they are and not have to travel to a lab to do the testing, which obviously fundamentally changes not only the nature of the testing and the speed and the cost, it also democratizes the audience, right? You don't have people who are able to, willing to, or need to take 6-7 hours out of their day to travel to a lab, to sit in the lab for the half hour or 15 minutes that our tests take and wait for it to happen and then take time to get back home again to be compensated for a higher price point. Now you have somebody who's getting the exact same experience and giving us the exact same measure, most importantly, remotely for a fraction of the cost and at their own home in 15 minutes. So
it would strike me that it's a more realistic representation of how somebody is likely to encounter the content, right?
Absolutely.
So you've created an efficiency, but you mentioned earlier that it, even with these efficiencies, it doesn't scale, or it doesn't scale to the point where a mid-sized business could take advantage of it. So explain that.
That starts to scale because as we get 200 people in the lab, becomes thousands of people in the field who we can turn on with a text or an email and say, hey, can you take this test right now in 15 minutes? And they open their phone, they put the watch-like device on, and they set it up in 2 minutes or a minute, make sure it's charged, set it up and put it on. And within 15 minutes, they've taken the test and been paid for their time. So if we can do that with thousands of people, not only for us to generate the test responses to our clients much faster and more affordably, it also changes the economies and the economies of scale for people. So we get a lot more people who are able to do that testing, and then it can scale up and it can scale in a pretty interesting way. What we've built DIRTT for from the jump is the idea that at some point, I just heard this great quote today from Nat Friedman, who's in AI from the Stratechery podcast. And he said, you know, the thing is, most people are other people. Most people are other people. And so if you play that out for me, how I thought about it this morning was at a certain point, once you've done hundreds of thousands or millions of these tests, most of how those brains are reacting can go into a machine learning setting and an AI-driven setting, and the machine can start to predict how a human mind would react rather than us needing to even do the test remotely. And that's what we're building to now, is version of our platform. I think there'll always be a need for a consultative model and real people and audiences for a client where they have their own recruit and their own demographic that they want to go after, the kind of users or heavy game players or people in beauty who are consistent, repeatable customers, where they're going to want to know exactly what those real audiences, those real people are thinking.
But yeah, where you really want sort of a lookalike to who you're.
Yeah, is, yeah. Right? And there, but what we're building to is the scalable, truly democratized version where any maker can use it akin to a generative AI model. And instead of uploading a prompt to receive back text or an image or a video, you're uploading an image or a video or audio even, and you're immediately, almost in real time, getting a feedback from the machine that predictively suggests how a human brain would react to it, so that as you work in your flow as a creator, and I'm talking game designers to anybody making a logo, to somebody writing, to somebody designing sneakers, to a UX and UI on a website that somebody's building, they can immediately, and most important, repetitively be running the versions of what they're working on to get a baseline of how those various versions theoretically or truly would connect with audiences, that they can always be optimizing for the best outcome on anything they're making.
So, okay. So some questions about that. How long, like for instance, could I show a film and get scene by scene reactions? How long a piece of content can it evaluate, and how granular is the feedback?
It's such a great question. I love where your brain goes on all this stuff. So what excited me yesterday, waking up in the morning, was Reed Hastings announcing the data dump that Netflix had done, right? And my brain as a filmmaker, and my friends who, I have a very close friend who is running one of the top shows on streamers right now. And when I first introduced what we did to him, he felt the same thing. He said, oh my God, could I show rough cuts? Could I show polished cuts? Could I show things to my audience and get insights? And yesterday, when I saw the data dump that Netflix had done of the shows that were watched for the most minutes, I immediately got on the phone, called my partners up on the West Coast, crack of dawn, and said, wait, we could do this to help them understand emotionally how the longer content is connecting. And absolutely one could. The more interesting and applicable space for me, not only from where I sit at Dirt, but really fundamentally as a filmmaker and as a person who understands what I want, is to draw the audiences in and get them to engage with my content. The poster art we're putting out, the trailers we're putting out, the 30-second trailers, the minute-long trailers, the hype trailers for gaming and film. I just saw one yesterday for a game that's being developed by Amazon Studios, Fallout, and running that through the machine and quickly understanding which parts of that 30-second or 60-second experience are grabbing attention, or even the tiles when you engage with Netflix and you open up the interface, are the images we're using as the core image to draw you in, are they the most resonant? Are they most likely to get you to click on these?
Well, and then do you stay? Because it has to deliver on the promise too.
And I want to be really careful here as a storyteller, maker, writer, there is no world in which people start at a lower baseline of something like, let's just call it relevance and attention and being engaged, in our point, a GSR score that is kind of lower, and consistently go up and up and up like a hill, being carried up a ski hill to a better experience where your GSR climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs, and then the show or the movie or whatever's over and it just went up the whole way. That's not how storytelling works or ever will work. You're going to want peaks.
Right. You need to have peaks and valleys,
especially as you get into 3-hour long. Like, that's not the intent. The intent is to show you are the valleys in the first 20 minutes and you don't get to peaks until 40. That's a problem.
Well, right. And where your episode breaks are.
And where anything loses attention. It's so funny because I'm a writer too, and I'll go back to pen and paper. I had a conversation with one of the top short story writers in the country, George Saunders, and he had, through this wonderful thing he has called Story Club, put out a tweet or a post or something years ago about, wouldn't it be nice if a writer like me had access to something that he termed the fiction machine, which was something that could tell me where my audience, my readers, before I release the final version, because all writing's right? That's what I know. That's what all writers know. That's what all producers, directors, makers know for all arts. Wouldn't it be nice if I had something called the fiction machine that could tell me when my audiences were more engaged and where I lost them? Not because it tells me what to write. It just gives me the insight that at this moment, I may not be connecting the way I had hoped to. And that's the most important thing for me. This isn't the emperor's thumbs up and thumbs down. We aren't telling creators from the C-suite to the design team, hey, here's what you have to do to make better art. We're showing them where it is potentially disconnecting, so that while they're in the never-ending process of reworking to make those things resonate more deeply, they have more tools at their disposal to give them better information to make those better artistic choices.
Well, and that is a caveat and an instruction on how to use this tool, which is so important. If we think about how some people use focus groups, I mean, you know this from your agency days, right? What a focus group can do and can't do. Although this, what's interesting in contrast to a focus group is it's not the loudest person who's controlling the story here.
I love that you said that. We get into VC world and you could hear me using the boring catchphrases like democratization. And what I mean is truly democratization. Like what I love here and beyond the marketing and let's build a company that can make a lot of money and do really well and have a lot of fun. What is purpose built here? And part of that purpose built starts with, I just inherently believe, leave surveys and A/B testing aside and talk about focus groups, the loudest voice in the room or the voice that's being directed in a certain direction is going to give you the answers that leave out some other people there. And I think traditionally, let's just call it, that's generally has been, still is, a loud white male voice. And that's not interesting to me. So to be able to go in and say, every voice matters, meaning every single person we engage with our platform is having the same input as anybody else. We aren't asking specific individuals to talk up and tell us what they think they feel. We're going to every one of these brains. Most people are other people. Most brains are other brains. Every one of them gets a say in the response.
Well, and you mentioned VCs. So where are you in your fundraising life cycle?
We're in a really great place. We just finished up a pre-seed round and we're about to go out for our seed raise. We've had some really, really terrific conversations in the past 2 weeks with people who'd be interested in taking a kind of the lead role in that seed round raise. This will push to next year and take longer than anybody anticipates because it always does. And most importantly, Gabrielle, for me, it's really wonderful to be in a place where we're coming in and having conversations with people, not trying to convince them we're right or they should invest, simply telling them what we're up to, confidently, not egotistically, but confidently sharing what we're doing and what we are going to build and saying, if this is something interesting to you and you can get behind it, great. And if it's not, that's not a problem. I'm not trying to tell you what I'm doing is right. I'm not fighting for a job in an interview. I'm telling you how I think and what we're doing and what we're pursuing. And if that fits with where you want to grow, fantastic. And to be
right,
able
you're
to
sharing, be, not selling.
Exactly. And to be able to be in that situation is a huge privilege that I'm aware of. But it's also, it allows us to engage in a fundamentally different way and to not necessarily play a classic startup role. And the thing is, we're not a startup. We've been profitable since day one.
So I was going to say, you're revenue positive and you have existing clients. That is a different profile.
Very different profile, which makes it tricky. And I would, the only advice I would say to anybody who's listening from that perspective is we're all a different profile. And this fits back to my journey over my career when I would go in and somebody say, well, what we're really looking for is an executive creative director who does this one thing or a chief creative officer who knows how to make X, Y, and Z. And I wasn't a good fit for that because I think my strength, whether I'm good at it or not, is that I'm curious about a lot of things and I want to put crazy pieces together to do something new. So to be able to go in and say, as a maker, as a startup founder, as whoever you are, there's a lot of language out there. There's a lot of rules of how you raise and go through Y Combinator and you have to do angel seed round. Like it's going to be trickier than those rules. And I think those rules are disingenuous. What I've found over the last 3.5 year journey, particularly, but throughout my career is if somebody tells you there's three things they're looking for, if you nail all three things in the very first conversation, they're going to tell you there are five more. You know, so I just feel like that's the space I'm in right now. And maybe that's just counsel I'm giving myself to so that I can relax over a holiday break. I don't know.
Well, I think it's pretty amazing. And I can't wait to see how it goes, what you build and having more conversations. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing.
Well, thank you so much for letting me get in the crazy weeds on all of that. I really appreciate the way you could dig in on things and the great questions.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking my production team at Up Next, my friend Rob Naughton, the voice artist, recorder at our open, and of course, all of you, the members of our audience. Thank you. I'll be talking to you again next time right here on Up Next.